This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Wir sind zurück beim Spitzenspiel zwischen Einnahmen und Ausgaben. Es bleibt spannend. Gewinn perfekt vorbereitet von Rendite, aber Lohnnebenkosten bleibt gefährlich. Und jetzt kommt Umsatzsteuer aufs Feld. Gutschrift zu Bonus, Bonus. Und da taucht plötzlich Spesenerstattung auf. Schuss! Oh, in letzter Sekunde hält der Notgroschen.
Finanzen werden nie so spannend sein wie Fußball, aber wir geben unser Bestes. Konto, Geschäftskonto, Unternehmensgründung, Buchhaltung.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. Inside our virtual space, you and I get briefed together on the big questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. And if it works for you, and especially if it doesn't and you know how it could, tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. This week, we're talking about the housing crisis in Britain. Did you know that back in the 1980s, it took a typical family 3 years to save enough money to put down on a deposit for a house? And today, that same family would have to save for 19 years. While they're doing that, they're paying an eye-watering proportion of their income in rent. The crisis isn't new, but shows no sign of going away. So this week we're asking, why can't we fix it? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room. There are plenty for you to listen to in our archive.
We cannot bring about the kind of society I want to see unless we tackle one of the biggest barriers to social mobility we face today. The national housing crisis.
Crisis. Talk about housing in Britain today, and everyone uses the same word. Why?
In much of the country, housing is so unaffordable that millions of people who would reasonably expect to buy their own home are unable to do so. Others are struggling even to find somewhere to rent.
And how is this supposed to have happened?
For decades, this country has failed to build enough of the right homes in the right places.
But is the Prime Minister right? Is the reason for this crisis simply the failure to build enough homes for purchase, or are the reasons more complex and the solutions quite difficult? Step inside the briefing room to find out. But first, what do we mean by a housing crisis in the first place? I invited Dan Tomlinson into the briefing room to tell me. He's a research analyst of the Resolution Foundation, a think tank whose stated aim is to improve the standard of living for low and middle income households. Dan Tomlinson, everybody talks about a housing crisis. Let's measure it. What does a housing crisis in terms of Britain actually mean?
So you'd think that would have a really simple answer to that question, but it is quite complex. There's lots of different factors involved in it. But I think there's two things worth bringing out. The first is the home ownership challenge that young people in particular are facing in the UK today. And so we've looked at home ownership rates among different generations. And the millennials, those people born in the 1980s and 1990s, are half as likely to own their own home when they get to age 30 as the baby boomers, those born in the two decades after the Second World War, as the baby boomers were when they were the same age. So there's clearly a home ownership challenge facing young people. And that is in large part about the high barriers to entry that there are for people wanting to be homeowners today. And by that, I mean, if we take a typical family trying to save for a typical deposit, back in the 1980s, it would take them 3 years to save for that. And now it takes them 19 years. Because house prices have increased so substantially, whereas incomes and earnings have remained relatively quite flat. Alongside the home ownership challenge in the UK, we also think it's worth focusing on the housing costs challenge. And that is, if we look at how much does housing cost relative to incomes, and people get worried when housing begins to take up more than a third of a family's income. And we've seen that a much greater proportion of families in the UK now have high, unaffordable housing costs, as in it's taking up more than a third of their income than in decades gone by. So, and that's not just about young people, that's about all people, but in particular, it's about those on lower and middle incomes.
Now, presumably that's as true for rented accommodation as it is for mortgaged or bought accommodation.
Yeah, that is a a much more broad-based phenomenon across ages and different tenures. And there's different things that matter there. One of them would be the decline in social housing. We've seen a drop in the share of the properties in the UK that are socially rented at much cheaper rents. But we've also seen...
From what to what?
So it's fallen from around 20% to around 15% today. It's a relatively small fall. The biggest change we've seen is the massive decrease in home ownership and increase in private renting.
Is this one of these things that differs regionally by where you are, that's worse in some place than others?
Yes, it is. The housing crisis is more acute in some parts of the country than others. That's definitely true. London and the South East, house prices have increased so much faster than incomes, whereas in other parts of the country, that increase is smaller. But it's not just a London and South East phenomenon, it's worth saying. We've looked at which part of the country saw the biggest decline in home ownership from when it was at its highest level to when it was at its trough. And that was Greater Manchester. So it's not just London, it's other cities and parts of the country where people want to live.
Are there any places actually where it's pretty easy to get to buy a house and to rent something?
Yeah, I'm sure there are. I think in parts of the North East and Scotland and Northern Ireland, the housing crisis is just much less acute than in London and the South East. So yeah, we shouldn't think it's a cross-country phenomenon, but this, in terms of home ownership, but this issue of rising housing costs, declining social housing and cuts to support for people on lower incomes in terms of their housing costs are affecting people across the whole country, meaning that it's more difficult for them to stretch their earnings to spend on other things that they might need or want because they've got to pay for their housing costs first.
So their housing costs have gone up as a proportion of their income. Do we know anything about what the knock-on effects are for, particularly, I'd have thought, for younger families?
Well, one of the really interesting things is that you might think, OK, housing costs have gone up as a share of income. Maybe younger people, maybe people on lower earnings are getting more for their housing. You might think they're paying more for it. But actually, we've seen that younger people are commuting further today than generations that went before them, and they're much more likely to be living in overcrowded accommodation.
You might have thought that this would self-correct a little bit with people deciding to take up jobs in areas where housing is cheaper.
So to some extent, I'm sure that that does happen, but people still really want to, A, own their own home, and B, live in areas where there are jobs and where the economy is growing much more significantly. And this feeds into a wider challenge that we have in the UK. And it's worth saying that the housing crisis here in the UK isn't just about housing. It's about an economy that is imbalanced and tilted towards London and the South East. And it's about an economy that hasn't been delivering the productivity growth that we need to see pay growth and increases in living standards. You know, we've seen the biggest squeeze on earnings in the UK. And this statistic isn't fake news. It's true. We've seen the biggest squeeze on earnings for in about 200 years here in the UK. So this isn't a phenomenon that's just about housing. It's also about living standards and about the nature of our economy and whether or not it's delivering for people.
Now, the United Kingdom is presumably not alone in facing this kind of crisis.
Not at all, no. There are other countries, not on the continent, in mainland Europe, that are struggling with housing crisis, but places like America, Canada, where we've seen some cities there have taken action to restrict foreign buyers from being able to purchase properties, and also places like Australia and New Zealand too.
Dan Tomlinson. So that's the problem. And as he says, we're not alone. So could we learn from some of those other countries Dan mentioned? New Zealand, for example, where the Labour-led government came to office last year, pledged to a radical policy concerning one very specific housing problem. Colin Peacock of Radio New Zealand sent this dispatch to the briefing room.
For generations, New Zealanders really have considered it a kind of birthright to own a home. For generations, homes were plentiful, land was plentiful, and houses were cheap and pretty affordable. But things have changed. In recent decades, we've had a growing population, and in recent years, we've had record levels of inward migration from overseas, which is something our government has encouraged. So fairly suddenly, younger New Zealanders have found that the kind of access to housing, the affordability that their parents enjoyed and their parents before them, has withered away, and suddenly houses have become very scarce. The property market really has overheated here in the past sort of 10 to 15 years or so. For example, in our big city, where this is at its most intense, Auckland in the north of New Zealand, it's a population of about 1.5 million people, growing fairly rapidly. If you go back to 2008, 10 years ago, the average price of a house there was about $500,000 New Zealand dollars, which is roughly £250,000 sterling. And if you fast forward another 9 years to where the government changed last year, 2017, that average price was more than $1 million. So quite a creep in that time. So younger New Zealanders who've grown up with this notion of a birthright, that once you get to a certain age, you will be able to buy a house if you've done the right thing, saved some money, and that will provide your family with security. That suddenly seemed very unachievable for anyone other than someone on a really top wage. One of the problems that has fueled this housing speculation and people's desire to invest in housing and acquire multiple houses if they possibly can is that there's no capital gains tax on sales. So there's no stamp duty or anything like that when you sell a home. So that means when you compare it to other forms of investment, it's really, really quite attractive. And when the house price inflation, particularly in Auckland, the big smoke, was really at its peak, that came to the attention of investors overseas. And for example, an Australian website was telling its readers this: no stamp duty, no land tax, a mortgage approved in as little as 5 working days, affordable housing with enormous potential for capital growth. Where is this investment paradise? Where do I sign up? And of course, the answer was New Zealand. And there was one incident where a New Zealander overseas heard an ad playing on the radio in Singapore with a New Zealand accented salesman urging Singaporeans to consider investing and actually saying, how would you like New Zealanders paying you an income?
How would you like people in New Zealand to give you around half their weekly wages? Now, if you happen to own an apartment in Auckland, New Zealand, the high rent returns, other people's money, around half a week's pay for most people, could be paid to you as rent every week.
And that, when it was played in the media here, really upset people and kind of fueled that issue. The Labour Party in opposition identified this as a big issue, and the current Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, said, look, we will do something about it, and that's what they've done.
Today, I can confirm that Cabinet and ministers have found and agreed a solution to make housing and home ownership more accessible for New Zealanders. The government will introduce the effect of this will mean that non-residents or non-citizens cannot purchase existing residential dwellings in New Zealand. With the exception, this presents and represents a simple, clean solution to help us act in the best interest of home buyers in New Zealand.
Some people are saying that now the government has taken action on this, that actually their timing isn't great because house prices, although they're volatile, appear to be coming down and the sales are slowing, as much as a third fewer sales in Auckland in the previous quarter, according to the latest data. So some people are saying, look, you really didn't need to take action. The market was so hot, it would have corrected itself anyway. And some of the economists are also pointing out that the first data that came through showed only about 4% of the buyers were actually individual foreign tax residents. So perhaps a symbolic piece of sort of politically low-hanging fruit, appearing as though they're making it easier for younger Kiwis to buy houses by cooling down the market, by keeping out those foreign buyers, might not actually end up having as great an impact on the market as the government had hoped.
Colin Peacock. So are restrictions and interventions like those in New Zealand any part of the answer to our housing problems? To talk about this and other questions about housing, I'm now joined in the briefing room by three experts. Christine Whitehead, who's Professor of Housing at the London School of Economics, Polly Neat, Chief Executive of the housing charity Shelter, and Andrew Whittaker of the Home Builders Federation, whose members build 80% of new homes in England and Wales. Christine Whitehead, you were listening to that report from Colin Peacock. I think you know something about the situation in New Zealand. What did you make of what they've done?
I think he's right that this is really a political decision. The proportion of people actually buying is not that large. It does have some impact on supply. It does mean you build a few more houses, but it's not going to really help the young people of New Zealand get into the housing market.
Pauline, do you agree with that? I mean, we've had some initiatives in Britain, like the second, trying to stop second home purchases in parts of Cornwall and so on. Do you think placing restrictions on what kind of people can buy in and the circumstances they can would have any significant effect on housing?
Well, I don't really think measures that are about tinkering with demand are going to sort the problem that we've got, which is one of supply. So unless we build vastly more homes, and particularly social housing actually is what is needed, not more sort of luxury homes for people to buy, you know, I don't think it'll make the difference. And I think, as everyone's already said, it, you know, it is could be a smart political move. The only thing it makes me think about, I guess, is the level of political salience of this issue in New Zealand, which is clearly very high, and it's going that way here. And I really hope it continues to, because what we really need is politicians concerning themselves with solving the housing crisis.
Well, that's a very important point about salience, and it's a very important point about supply. So everybody agrees the main problem is that we don't build enough homes. The government target is 300,000 new homes a year, and we're not hitting that. Andrew, from your perspective and from your expertise, why do we not build enough houses?
Well, let's get off on the right foot. I think we are starting to move in the right direction. Housing output has grown to 217,000 additional dwellings last year, and the industry has increased output by 74% over the last 4 years. If we need to build more houses to meet more housing demand, then we need to plan for more housing, and we need to make sure that the industry and anyone else who needs to deliver housing can deliver that housing.
One of the points that Polly Neat made was a significant proportion of this essentially has to be social housing. Do you agree with that perception?
I think it's fair to look at the statistics, to look at the needs of individual people and say, what tenure of housing do you need? But it's a bit of a red herring, because fundamentally, if we need 100 houses of whatever tenure and we only build 90, 10 people are going to miss out, regardless of what tenure they want. If we want more social housing, then let's fund more social housing. If we want to encourage people into home ownership, let's give them more products that allow them to enter home ownership.
I understand that point, but I think the issue is, if we seriously want to build 300,000 buildings a year, the buildings that are needed are social homes. That's the point. So where we have a shortfall and where we don't have enough supply to meet demand is on the affordable end of the market, and specifically in social housing. And the system isn't going to, the market system we have isn't going to sort of magically deliver more social housing unless we do something about particularly the cost of land, which is what is driving developers, because they spend so much for land, they then have to build luxury homes in order to recoup that money and make a profit, because that's what they're in business to do. Absolutely fair enough. And what that then means is that the affordable housing and the social housing just gets cut out every single time.
Christine Whitehead, when I was a boy, social housing meant housing for rent.
Yes.
These days, when we talk about social housing, we often seem to be talking about essentially housing that's bought from the people who make it, but at the lower end of the range.
Well, we do have to be careful about what we do mean by social housing. I mean, the times when you and I were of that age group, social housing was 30% of the stock, and a large number of people in the middle areas were able to get into it and lived in social housing. Now we need to fill the gap between the extreme social housing and the easy market housing, and we therefore have shared ownership and help to buy and other means of helping people a little further up the system. That, of course, leaves the problem of the people who can't afford it. But the people who are really suffering at the moment, the people who are in private rented housing or not able to form a household at all. And these people are paying very high rents, and they are not able to afford the necessities of life.
Absolutely.
Now, the difficulty about social housing is that the person who gets in is able to do that, mostly, but the person who doesn't get in has no help other than welfare, and welfare means that they get nothing for doing their work most of the time.
Pauline, does that mean that our concentration in when we talk about the housing crisis on younger homeowners is mistaken?
I don't think younger homeowners aren't important, but that's not where the housing crisis lies. The housing crisis
is where the politics tends to lie.
It can be, although actually the politics is shifting, I think, almost as we speak. It's absolutely right that people in private renting are absolutely at the sharp end. But I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the reason for that is because there isn't enough social housing,
which is where they ordinarily would be. Because we're never going to build the sort of social housing which will deal with that whole range of people in the private rented sector who are really doing extremely badly out of it. Social housing, even if you built 100,000 a year for a while, will not carry out anything like the levels that
Well, it's not an either-or, is it?
So no, we have to do both.
Of course, we have to, and there aren't enough rights for people who are renting in the private sector. Tenancies aren't long enough, and unfortunately, the government is looking at this at the moment. It's consulting on three-year tenancies at the moment, which would be a really good step forward. Of course, and the single biggest cause of homelessness, actually, I mean, we're seeing individuals and families coming into our frontline services around the country every single day who are homeless because they've been evicted from a private tenancy. That's the biggest cause of homelessness. And yes, of course, they need protection against that eviction, and housing benefit needs to be of a level that they can afford to buy food and pay their rent. But more social housing is going to have a big impact on that problem.
Now, I want to come back to that in a moment also. And also, if you like, what was raised in the New Zealand package, really, which is the sort of, what would you call it, a kind of Anglophone reliance upon home ownership, that kind of concept, and then the idea of your house as being essentially an investment rather than a service. But in the first instance, Andrew, talking about land and how scarcity of land and land use acts as a restriction upon the capacity to build housing, do you recognise that?
Oh, absolutely. And that's fundamentally driven by the planning system and by local planning authorities and, quite frankly, their failure to allocate enough land to be developed for housing over the last 20 or 30 years since we had a plan-led system.
By my memory, governments have been worrying about that problem for a couple of decades now. Why haven't we tackled that now?
We haven't tackled it because we've left it to local people to make local decisions. And whilst in a democratic society that sounds like a good idea, those local people are not going to vote for a lot of the things that we actually need. You'll never see a neighbourhood plan allocate a site for an abattoir or a sewage treatment works. And people have said, well, what we don't want in our neighbourhood plan or in our neighbourhood is new housing. I think that's changing. I think people are starting to see that it's their children that are suffering in the housing crisis. They can't afford to house themselves and they don't see why, and they are starting to do something about it.
Christine?
I think that there's far too much emphasis on new build as such. Yes, we don't have enough land. Yes, we need to build more. But even if we build the 300,000 a year, which we're not going to, by the way, not in the next few years, that's going to be less than 1% of the total stock. What we need to be doing as well, and probably more importantly, is to be allocating the total stock better, to be using the existing housing in a more effective way. And we have a system incentivizing people not to move, and we're running into a situation with massive under-occupation in the owner-occupied sector, and people just sitting in houses which they're not very happy with, unable or unprepared to move.
Let's say there's a country in which they do it better, in which you have an allocation of existing housing stock better. What are they doing differently to what we're doing?
Well, one of the things they're doing is that they've got better taxation systems. We have a system by which I live in a large house which I moved into a long while ago, and where my council tax is only £100 a year more than it was when I moved in 30 years ago. So the people who are consuming the housing are really not paying their way in the neighbourhood, in the community.
This is a real problem. This is caused by people getting older, living longer, and yet we do very little in policy terms to encourage local authorities to plan properly for specialist products for older people, for example, to find sites for those kind of products in locations where older people want to live, which tend to be different to where younger people want to live.
In what way?
Well, in terms of access to facilities, younger people want access to, paraphrase, nightclubs and vibrant places, and older people want access to doctors, surgeries, hospitals, open space, those kind of things.
Kristen, you don't want access to nightclubs, apparently.
I wouldn't mind a bit of access to nightclubs. More importantly, I do think that it is scary watching how divided it is. I mean, you go into a town at 11 o'clock in the morning and everybody is my age. And it really is shaking how much I think we need community mixing rather than separation in that way.
Now, Pauline, one of the reasons for this, I imagine, is because we regard our houses not just as places that we live, but places that are racking up significant capital gains for us, which we might eventually want to turn into money.
You can't blame people for that in one sense, because in recent times, people have seen the value of their homes going up and up. They might actually have suffered financially in other ways. Pensions, for a start, are not as good as they used to be. So it is people do see their home as their security for the future. But I think we're not kind of having a reality check about younger people coming through for whom that is not a realistic aspiration, certainly at the moment. And more importantly, the people who simply cannot participate in the housing market at all. So, you know, we've got 1.2 million people on council waiting lists. We've got 300,000 people homeless in this country, and there's absolutely nothing for them. So every part of the market system, if you like, is failing to deliver.
We do seem to have a bit of a cultural obsession, don't we, with owner occupation here in Britain. I mean, in other countries, I'm thinking particularly of Germany, there's a much higher level of rented accommodation, isn't there? Christine?
The German rental system is very, very different from ours. If you have to put in your own bathroom, you tend to want to stay there for quite a long while, and that is quite normally the case in Germany. You have to apply for your housing, and you might fill in 70 or 80 forms, each of which takes 3 hours to do, in order to get your rental housing. So we did a study of owner occupation across the world in terms of industrialised countries. Germany, Japan, all sorts of places. At age 45, everybody who was of that sort of stable family type were in owner occupation, 80% plus in Germany, just as much as in Britain. The difference was that they got in later and they didn't want to get in earlier, rather than very specifically that they never wanted to be owners. They do at some stage.
Yeah, I think there is another issue as well, which is that the rental system, as you rightly said, is very different here. It's not a system that supports people to view their rented home as their long-term home. And that is a problem, and that is something that we could do something about by changing the laws around
rent. It's an incredibly circular argument that we have constantly, in that we want people to aspire to own their own home. And then when lots of people do own their own home, we say, oh, that's really bad for people who can't afford to own their own home. And then we try and encourage more rental properties. And then we say, but that's not really great because people don't want to live in rental properties for the rest of their life. They aspire to home ownership. We can't make up our minds.
Well, I don't think the fact that a lot of people own their own home is what causes the problems for the people who can't afford to participate in the property market. What causes the problems for them is there isn't enough housing being built that they can afford.
I think what this conversation shows is that the housing crisis is not one crisis. It is a lot of different crises. It is undoubtedly the case that our particular form of arrangements are extremely bad for people who want a longer-term tenancy. And I'm very pleased that the government is thinking around it. I think their suggestions are not the best by a long way. But we should have a system which looks much more like other countries, where you have extended or possibly indefinite tenancies. But we have a good enforcement system so that the bad tenant is kicked out and the good landlord doesn't lose 6 months' rent in the process. So we have to do both things, all things. New build, part of it.
Christine Whitehead, Polly Neat and Andrew Whittaker. And my thanks also to Dan Tomlinson and Colin Peacock. That's it from us. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Jonathan Harvey and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme, or indeed the entire series, and you can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We adore hearing from you.